Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising. This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and in the early hours of Friday the 4th of October, these are our main stories. President Trump has publicly asked a second foreign power, China, to investigate one of his main political rivals, Joe Biden, and his son. French police are investigating why one of their employees killed four of his colleagues with a knife at the police headquarters in Paris. Also,
for them, a woman is an object. When they finish with her, they throw her away. They are like animals. They eat the flesh and throw away the bones.
A shocking BBC report on so-called pleasure marriages in Iraq. And in this podcast, new research finds that the trade in wildlife is driving some creatures towards extinction. Plus, can you forgive the person who kills your child?
If you'd have said to me the day before my son was killed, Margaret, if someone hurt one of your children, what would you do? I'd have said, if anyone touches my children, I will kill them. And yet, or 2 days after that, I'm talking about forgiveness.
And how a Russian man is accusing the manufacturer Apple of making him gay. As if the impeachment inquiry surrounding his request to the Ukrainian government to investigate rival Joe Biden isn't enough, President Trump is also now demanding that China investigate Mr. Biden and his son, Hunter.
Well, I would think that if they were honest about it, they'd start a major investigation into the Bidens. It's a very simple answer. They should investigate the Bidens, because how does a company that's newly formed, and all these companies, if you look at, and by the way, likewise, China should start an investigation into the Bidens. Because what happened in China is just about as bad as what happened with Ukraine.
President Trump. But Adam Schiff, the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, which is looking into the Ukrainian side of the story, condemned Mr. Trump's comments.
I find, once again, the president inviting another country to interfere in our presidential elections repugnant and a fundamental breach of his oath of office. It endangers the security of our elections and is a betrayal of the idea that Americans should decide who leads America, not foreign parties who seek to intervene in our affairs.
So, why did the US president do it? I asked our correspondent in Washington, Gary O'Donoghue.
Well, it seems to relate to an incident in 2013, or at least started then, when Joe Biden, as vice president, travelled to China, and he took Hunter Biden, his son, with him, and then he took his granddaughter, in fact, as well. That wasn't unusual for Joe Biden. He did often travel with family members. But the allegation, or it seems the allegation from the Trump team, is that around that same time, Hunter Biden was setting up a private equity firm in China. 10 days after that trip, they got the license for it. But Donald Trump claims that Hunter Biden made $1.5 billion out of that whole deal, despite not having any experience. Now, the Bidens have denied all that. They've denied that any money was invested until after Joe Biden left his job, and it was only $400,000 or something, like I say only, but a lot less than Donald Trump said. And the Bidens have now issued a statement describing the president as flailing and producing a meltdown on television, talking about that particular appearance there, and that the conspiracy theories, as they describe them, have been debunked.
Could this affect the impeachment proceedings, which are ongoing?
It adds to that whole momentum. And bear in mind, the Democrats believe they've got a pretty good case with Ukraine in terms of the call that was made to the president there. They're also considering adding a charge around obstruction, because they've given the White House until tomorrow to produce documents. If they don't do that, they're thinking about making that part of the impeachment as well. I suppose in some way you could see the president's actions on the China thing today, as a way of keeping up pressure on the Bidens, but also maybe as a way of kind of normalising or attempting to normalise the idea that it's OK to put pressure on foreign governments in a way that people have thought on that call it wasn't OK. It's a strange strategy, but he is doubling down without any doubt.
Gary O'Donoghue in Washington. Now to Paris and the latest on Thursday's attack there. It's emerged that the policeman who knifed and killed four of his colleagues at a police headquarters was a recent convert to Islam. The man, who's not been named, was shot dead just after the attack. Hugh Schofield reports.
Police sources have confirmed that the 45-year-old assailant converted to Islam some 18 months ago. He was born in the French Caribbean island of Martinique and had worked as an administrative assistant in police headquarters in Paris for 16 years. He also suffered from partial deafness. Following the attack, police have been searching his home in the northern Paris suburb of Gonesse. His partner, who's also reported to be Muslim, has been taken into custody. Officials say that the man's employment record was exemplary, and they're keeping an open mind about what is still being treated as a criminal, not terrorist crime.
Hugh Schofield. How far should what's seen as defamatory in one country or jurisdiction be seen as defamatory in another? In what observers are calling a landmark decision, the European Union's highest court ruled on Thursday that member states can order Facebook to remove illegal content beyond their borders. The tech giant will now have to patrol its platform worldwide to remove posts that have been declared unlawful within the EU. Mark Scott is chief technology correspondent at Politico.
The case dates back to 2016 when an Austrian lawmaker asked Facebook to take down some quite defamatory content about herself. That eventually made its way to the highest court in the European Union, which decided today that not only does Facebook have to take down that content, it has to take it down potentially globally across all its social networks.
And is this content that is essentially just a replication of what has been said in a defamatory fashion within the EU, or can it be anything that is vaguely similarly defamatory about this particular politician?
So it has to be quite identical to what was said in the first instance back in 2016, although frankly there is some grey area about if the similar content, how equivalent it is to the first post. So frankly, it's going to be up to an Austrian court now to decide how to apply the law.
How did the European Court of Justice justify saying that the rules of defamation should apply beyond the European Union?
So there is a European Union law that dates back to the year 2000, and the highest court is using this law to say that at no point in this legislation does it say that Europe cannot apply its rules worldwide, and therefore that is the legal basis for which the judges made the ruling for today.
Does it deal at all with the possibility? I mean, maybe I'm sort of trying to find complexity where there isn't any, but if somebody in the United States wanted, say, to post some information or a post that had been ruled defamatory in the EU, but said that they were able to do so under the First Amendment of the Constitution, the right to freedom of expression, that they could say that Facebook taking down that post somehow constrained their right to freedom of expression and take Facebook to the Supreme Court?
Potentially, yes. And I think that's what strikes at the key part of this ruling. And frankly, not to get too overblown, but it's about can Europe expand and export its digital rules, be it around content, be it around data protection, to the rest of the world. And so for in the case you mentioned, it would frankly be find Facebook between a rock and a hard place, the rock being the US First Amendment and the hard place being the European Union law, which is now obligating it to take down such potential content worldwide.
I guess Facebook probably aren't that happy about this ruling.
They are telling me this afternoon that this is sort of an attack on freedom of expression and that Europe should not be allowed to export its own way of life and its own rules. It comes down to the how any type of court, be it Europe's highest court or any other in Europe, how can they actually apply this law worldwide other than, you know, asking Facebook to be nice and do it for them.
Mark Scott, chief technology correspondent at Politico, talking there to Tim Franks. A BBC News Arabic undercover investigation into marriage offices run by Shia Muslim clerics near some of Iraq's most important shrines has found that most of the clerics approached were willing to provide pleasure marriages for very short periods of time to enable sex. Some are also willing to provide these time-limited marriages to girls as young as nine. BBC's Nawal Amagafi has this exclusive report. A warning, you may find some of the content distressing.
This is Qadhimiyya in central Baghdad, one of Shia Islam's most important pilgrimage sites. Millions visit this holy shrine every year. In the streets around the shrine are marriage offices where couples come to get wed. But they also hold one of Iraq's darkest secrets. We've heard that some Shia clerics are performing a controversial religious practice called muta, or pleasure marriage. This allows a man to pay for a temporary wife. They're illegal in Iraq, but we've found evidence that they're being used to exploit women and young girls. It's impossible to know how widespread this is, but out of 10 clerics we spoke to, 8 said they performed it. Sayyid Raad was one. Our reporter told him he'd met a 13-year-old girl and wanted to have halal, or religiously permissible, sex for just half an hour of marriage. Our secret recording is noisy, but there's no doubt. Sayyid Raad said sex with the girl would be fine.
Just be careful that she doesn't lose her virginity.
Outside real marriage, said the cleric, vaginal sex is forbidden if the girl is still a virgin. But there were other ways for what he called foreplay. We then went to Karbala, the biggest Shia pilgrimage site in the world. Like Qadhimiyya, there are marriage offices all around the shrine run by clerics. One of them was a man called Sheikh Salawi. He said he belonged to one of Iraq's feared Shia militias. Our undercover reporter pretended he'd met a 12-year-old girl and asked if the Sheikh was certain that sex with her would be allowed.
Yes, 9 years old plus, there's no problem at all. According to Sharia, there is no problem.
After 15 years of conflict, there are an estimated 1 million widows struggling to support their children in Iraq. For a poor family without a male guardian, marrying the daughter off is often the only option, making women and young girls vulnerable to the powerful clerics who have the access to aid. I met a woman we're calling Reem. Her husband was killed in an IS bombing. Soon after, she and her 2 children lost their home and came to rely on charity from a cleric.
But he proposed a pleasure marriage with me. To be honest, I accepted, but I didn't want this thing. I was forced to do it in order to survive.
After a few months, Reem says the cleric started selling her to his friends.
They wanted violent sex. I felt abused. I was forced. Raped.
Clerics had told us pleasure marriages were a way of helping vulnerable women. But stories like Reem's show they're being abused and used for sexual exploitation. We sought a response from Sheikh Salawi, but he didn't reply. Sayyid Raad denied that he offers any pleasure marriages at all. Both say they're followers of Grand Ayatollah al-Sistani, one of the most senior figures in Shia Islam. We put our findings to his office, which released the following statement. If these practices are happening in the way you are saying, then we condemn them unreservedly. Temporary marriage is not allowed as a tool to sell sex in a way that belittles the dignity and humanity of women. Reem managed to escape her cleric, but she remains traumatized.
For them, a woman is an object. When they finish with her, they throw her away. They don't see her as a human being with feelings. They are like animals. They eat the flesh and throw away the bones.
Reem ending that special BBC investigative report from Nawal Al-Magafi. Before we continue, let's hear about another World Service podcast.
I'm Kim Chakanetsa, and I'm the host of The Conversation podcast from the BBC World Service.
Oh boy, I'm overwhelmed with so much to say in such a short time.
Some recent favourites include an episode on female roadies, these two incredible women who've just been touring the world with musicians and had some incredible stories to tell.
This is a live show and sometimes things go wrong, and tonight something's gone wrong.
I also found the episode on women living with schizophrenia incredibly powerful.
She does not believe that there's such a thing as a mental illness. She still thinks that perhaps it was a demonic possession that happened to me.
Another episode was about women who were standing up to street harassment.
I'm sick of it. It's in front of my house, it's in my street, it's near my train station, it's all the time.
And I've always had female flight attendants on my wish list, and we finally got to speak to two women who had spent a lot of time up there.
People just stormed the door because they had to get off the plane. They were so scared.
That's The Conversation from the BBC World Service.
You can't put price tag on these emotions.
Search for The Conversation wherever you found this podcast.
The market in wildlife is far larger than previously thought, according to a new scientific study. The State of Nature report for 2019 examines data from almost 7,000 species and draws on expertise from dozens of wildlife organisations and government agencies. The research found that the trade is driving some creatures towards extinction. Our environment and nature correspondent Helen Briggs told me more.
They highlighted a few species here. So the point being really that something can suddenly rocket in terms of popularity. Something like the pangolin in decades has become very threatened because of the appetite for scales. Also, things like songbirds, which are valued for their feathers. So it's the whole gamut of global wildlife trade. And some of that will be legal and some of that will be illegal. But the point they're making really is this is very, very extensive. It's more prevalent than we thought. But also there's this whole new list of animals that they think could be the ones that are traded in the future. So by looking at things people value in terms of pets, you know, exotic colours, feathers, that kind of thing, they've been able to look through the tree of life and get this watch list, if you like, for things that may be traded in the future.
Which species are on the watch list then?
Other birds that may be seen as beautiful as some of the ones that are traded at the moment, or exotic amphibians and reptiles, the sort of things that people go into pet shops and buy. But the crucial thing they're saying really is that it's a really big cause of extinction, the global wildlife trade. It's the number one cause, tied with changes in land use, so loss of natural habitat, that kind of thing. But the mechanisms we have to deal with it tend to be reactive rather than proactive. So it can take a long time for a species to be recognised as becoming extinct and then to put the mechanisms in place to stop this wildlife trade. So they're saying we need to be going out there looking at species that are on this watch list, stopping illegal trading at borders. And there are things that individuals can do. So, you know, if you go somewhere and you're offered some sort of exotic meat that you think has been caught from the wild, maybe illegally, then don't eat it. Another point is education on the ground, and also communities where people actually may be making their living hunting these animals. You need to actually give those people another source of income. You need to educate people about conservation. And those things are going on around the world. I speak to people all the time who are trying to do that, but it's a big, big task. But the scientists are quite horrified, really, by this study and are keen to put out this message that more needs to be done.
Helen Briggs. 18th century England was a society characterised by corruption, greed and vanity. That at least is the impression you get from the sketches by William Hogarth. Now, for the first time, an exhibition bringing together many of his works will open next week in London. They include the 8-part A Rake's Progress and the 6 pictures that make up Marriage à la Mode. Our arts correspondent Rebecca Jones has been given early access to see the pictures being hung.
Gin, sex and lunacy, all going up on the walls at Sir John Soane's museum. You're face to face with the excesses of Georgian society. In the 4 oil paintings known collectively as The Humours of an Election, Hogarth depicts political corruption. One shows the dying being dragged to vote. In the series of pictures called The Four Times of Day, beggars and prostitutes populate the streets of London.
You wouldn't even get top and bottom.
Joanna Tinworth, exhibitions curator at the museum, says Hogarth himself called them modern moral subjects.
The painted series of Hogarth are almost like a collection of scenes in a play. He puts six or eight paintings or four paintings together that tell a story. And what was so innovative about what he was doing is that they were stories of 18th century contemporary life.
Now all Hogarth's surviving series of paintings are being brought together for the first time. The director of the museum, Bruce Boucher, says loans have come from collections across the country.
I think it's wonderful and refreshing to see them in a different context. It reaffirms Hogarth's unique status among British artists as a social critic.
From A Rake's Progress in 1732 to The Humours of an Election painted more than two decades later, the exhibition will not only chart Hogarth's development as an artist, but will also showcase some of the most biting satirical pictures ever produced.
Rebecca Jones. Science has shown that people don't become homosexual or lesbian. They simply are gay or are not. As a result, it's come as a surprise that a man in Russia has filed a lawsuit against Apple, claiming that an iPhone app turned him gay. Media in Moscow says that the man, who they name as D. Razumilov, has filed a court suit asking for €1 million, or $15,000. Katie Silver told us more.
Basically, what we know is that according to the claimant, he ordered Bitcoin through a smartphone app, but instead something called Gaycoin arrived, which is a cryptocurrency that you may not have heard of, but it's one that's currently valued at less than 2 cents. And so 69 of these Gaycoins arrived and allegedly came with a note that said, "Don't judge until you try." And so the claimant says that encouraged him to try. In his statement, and I'll read this to you, he said, "I thought, in truth, how can I judge something without trying? I decided to try same-sex relationships. Now I have a boyfriend, and I do not know how to explain this to my parents. My life has been changed for the worse and will never become normal again. Apple pushed me towards homosexuality through manipulation. The changes have caused me moral and mental harm." Now, his lawyers say that the US technology giant has a responsibility for their programs, even though this alleged exchange took place on a third-party app. And you'll know that attacks on LGBT people are pretty commonplace. Now, Apple hasn't yet responded to a request for comment, and the court's going to make a decision on this in 2 weeks.
Katie Silver. The president of Cameroon, Paul Biya, has ordered the release of more than 300 prisoners who'd been detained in connection with the Anglophone separatist rebellion. The announcement was made during a week-long conference aimed at finding solutions to the three-year conflict, which has left thousands dead and 500,000 displaced. Our Africa regional editor Will Ross reports.
President Paul Biya's statement says the trials of 333 people who've been before military tribunals will now be stopped. That appears to be quite a significant gesture, but his statement says this amnesty is only for people who have committed what he calls misdemeanors, and so it's highly unlikely to apply to any separatist fighters. For that reason, this move is clearly not a game changer. There are also few signs of progress at the major peace conference in the capital, Yaoundé. Many Anglophone delegates are angry that the government's refusing to allow discussion about the idea of granting any autonomy to the regions of Cameroon.
Will Ross. And to end this podcast, for the last couple of days, the outcome of a murder case in Dallas, Texas, has attracted a great deal of attention. Amber Geiger, a white former police officer, shot dead her black neighbour in his apartment. She'd claimed that she thought it was her apartment, and Botham Jean, the man she shot, was an intruder. Ms. Geiger was sentenced to 10 years in prison. That was followed by an emotional statement from the victim's brother, 18-year-old Brant Jean, saying he forgave her, and then they hugged. But how do you forgive someone for such a crime? In 1973, Marietta Yeager's 7-year-old daughter Susie was murdered. Marietta wanted to kill the person who took her daughter, but her Christian faith led her to forgive him. Margaret Mizzam's 16-year-old son was murdered in London in 2008. She too has chosen forgiveness. We brought the two women together on air to talk about their experiences. And we start with Margaret.
Very soon, I come to the conclusion that I forgave the boy that killed my son because I had a need to get through each day. I had a need to get up and up. I had a need to smile again. And I knew that if I didn't forgive this boy, I couldn't do all of those things. And so I just felt, for me, in my heart, it felt easier to forgive him than to hold on to the hate that would have been a poison inside my body. And it means that I can get up each day and smile and look out of the window and see the sun shining or even the rain coming down, that I couldn't do if I didn't forgive.
I understand exactly how she felt and the process she had to go through. But it's true. Death is, a loved one is such a difficult thing to for our minds to embrace. But once we do, we can move on with our lives. And we can, as she said, smile and be happy to see a rainbow and life will go on. And we're not stuck in the past where we can do nothing to change it. No matter how angry we are, it's not going to change what we have to learn to live with.
I absolutely agree with that. And, you know, many people are interested in forgiveness. And my husband and I, we have started up a charity called For Jimmy. And our charity is based on three words: forgiveness, peace and hope. And we travel all around our country sharing the message of forgiveness, and people are craving forgiveness, but they don't know how to forgive. And sometimes it's just letting that peace come into your heart, and we can smile, but that doesn't mean to say it's not painful still, the loss of our beautiful son. It is, but you know, you still got to get through life. And I have other children that need me, and I know that if I didn't forgive the boy that killed my son, I couldn't be there for them as well. But if you'd have said to me the day before my son was killed, "Margaret, if someone hurt one of your children, what would you do?" I'd have said, "If anyone touches my children, I will kill them." And yet, or 2 days after that, I'm talking about forgiveness.
Oh, I really agree with that. It's interesting, the parallels in our life. I, along with the other people, have this organization called Journey of Hope, From Violence to Healing. And we find that as we go around the country and share our stories, people say, "Oh, I just never thought there was that option." You know, hatred isn't healthy, and they're suffering from it. And so when they see somebody hold that light out in front of them, it gives them hope that there's a chance for them to be happy again, to be able to enjoy life again.
I've seen a lot of pain in my children since the death of Jimmy. And so if it came about that I had an opportunity to meet the boy that killed him, I would sit down with my family and ask them, "Is that okay?" But I have to say, if one of my children said, "Mum or Dad, we don't want you to meet Jake," then I wouldn't. Because the one thing I'm not going to do is cause my children any more pain. But if it was left to me alone, I probably could put my arms around him.
I just love listening to Margaret because her journey is, again, so parallel to mine. I speak in prisons and I visit prisons. And I have come to love these men who have made terrible, terrible mistakes and have to live with the reality, the consequences of those mistakes for the rest of their lives. But so many of them have said to me that the one thing that would really help to heal them is to know that the victim's family forgave them. And I think that's a very interesting insight. And hopefully the day will come when instead of promoting death and anger and executions, that our justice system will have means to promote, better spend their money on the promotion of rehabilitation.
Marietta Yeager in the United States and Margaret Mizzen here in the UK. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Valerie Saunderson. Until next time, bye-bye.